With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the French Rugby Podcast with me, Tim Groves, former France hooker Benjamin Kayser, and ex-Scotland back row Johnny Beattie. Bon année, guys. Is it too late to say that, mid-January?
Never too late. You have until the 31st of January to say it. It's always nice to hear, you know, best wishes of this, best wishes of that. I think this year it's health, 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 and the rest you can all get stuffed, right? You roll your sleeves up and you just do your own homework. But at the moment, it's health, health for everyone, and that's it.
Exactly. And it can only get better, 100%. Here's to 2021.
Absolutely. And how was the end of 2020? Good Christmas, good New Year?
Oh, well, I've got a funny story around Christmas because all hell broke loose. Is that what you say?
Absolutely, yeah.
Ooh, hello, yes. after that Bayonne-Leicester game, which I commentated for French TV and not knowing that basically that was the game that was going to kick off, you know, the shitstorm about the difference of, well, first that English variant that arrived in the world and then how it's impacted on rugby and all that. And I'm in France, 2 days before Christmas. I would love to be in France for Christmas, but I would still rather be with my wife and girls, you know? and so basically I'm thinking, oh shit, this is going to happen. And please don't tell my wife. Good thing she doesn't listen to the podcast because I didn't take the first flight back. I took the second flight back because to you, Johnny, I wanted Bayonne is an hour and a half from Bordeaux. And Bordeaux is where I have my second Inu Park shop that I haven't really seen yet. So I wanted to spend the time to do it. And I'm there in the shop sweating like a piglet because I'm just looking at the news. Oh, France is shutting borders. This is shutting. And I'm trying to call EasyJet to change my flight. No. This flight is being canceled. And that flight is being canceled. And the other one's being canceled. And I'm thinking, oh, shit, this is going to be long. Basically texting my wife in the same time. Yeah, no, it's all right. Don't worry. Yeah, my flight is all good. So, you know, maybe I'll get tested here if I can, if I have the time, you know. But, you know, we're all good. And I get to the airport. Hallelujah. Some whatever reason, my flight did go at 6 o'clock or whatever. And it's full ram-packed. Is to say that they bust your balls about being careful with gel, with masks. But then in the flight, everybody was touching each other. I said, what kind of thing is it? It's space out, people. You know, the world is...
What kind of flight was it? Why are you touching each other?
EasyJet. No, you know what I mean. And it's like, oh, well. And so basically, I did get there. We all got tested on the Tuesday. And everybody's all right. That was really good fun to have to go test my little ones. So elbow in the face, second hand, holding both hands down. Yes, stuffing those things in the nose, that was no fun, but they did well. Oh, and everybody's all right. So I thought I almost got locked there, and then I realized because of that variant, because of that particular game, how much it's impacted top 14 rugby. So it was a fun weekend,
and European stuff as well. Now it's gone everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, for European, I don't know what you think, Johnny, but they didn't really have much of a choice, did they? It's just too hot, too young, too sudden, and the French government has got to step on it. I think it's a matter. Remember, I always said to you that I really do think sport has got a responsibility to lead by example in terms of not sulking, of being happy. We're there to promote a fun, positive, huge experience. But also they got to lead by example by saying the week when they announce how bad this variant is in England, you're not going to have, rugby games where 45 guys travel all the time, where nobody's in a bubble.
Exactly. And so the weird thing with rugby is you've got this task of inspiring people and entertaining people and having fun and keeping it turning and being on TV and giving some people to watch. But then ultimately, you just said it, you got a traveling band of 50 people who, if it's picked up in a game with one scrum, one maul, They go back home, they see their wives, they see their kids, they all go to the shops, they all go to supermarkets, they all go to school, and it just spreads like wildfire. So as much as, yes, we love to see our sport continue, they had no choice. They've got absolutely no choice, especially with the cross-border competition. That's why, looking a little bit further ahead, Six Nations, is it going to go ahead? We don't know, but it was the right thing to do. You had to close it down because it just spreads like wildfire. And that's it. There's 50 of you traveling. It goes exponentially. So yeah. Absolutely the right thing to do. The one good thing you have to say, in contrast to Premiership rugby, the one thing that I have enjoyed with Top 14 is that they've said, let's use these 2 weeks now. They've acted quickly. Let's catch up on games.
Why do you think they've been able to do that, whereas the Premiership have, by all accounts, the Premiership clubs have not all bought into that? So have the top 14 clubs all bought in?
I don't know, actually. I don't know. Do you know why, Tim, why the Premiership said no? Not so much why the French said yes.
Exactly.
Why did the Premiership rugby say no?
Because in the Premiership, all of the clubs have to agree to it. So we had Rob Baxter, Pat Lamb, Lee Blackett, they're three of came out and said they'd really like to do it, but then Worcester have kind of said or inferred that they didn't, and if you haven't got buy-in from all of them, they haven't been able to do it, basically.
And why would you not be buying in? So you got to say, so Bayonne, for instance, I take them as the example. They were part of the group that they caught that strain. They now need anything they can in the coffers and to play these games and to play their home games and get points on the board. So they're not fussed about European rugby. And I would think, looking across the water, Worcester would be in the same boat. So what's the difference? Why do Worcester not need the points and they don't want to get up that Premiership, whereas Bayonne are desperate to get top 14 games played and get points banked? That's what I don't understand.
Yeah,
I think I agree completely with Pat Lamb, with Baxter. They all came out in the press. I thought that was great. And I cannot see a reason, apart from being underhand or not wanting to play games or wanting to pick up free points, is the only thing that I can think of. But no, I think it's great. Top 14's back on, games are back on, they're taking place, people are staying fit, which again leads to less injuries, because if you're chucking people into games after 3 weeks off and training in little bubbles, it's dangerous. So no.
There's also, Johnny, a little something that brings us back to our ongoing theme about French rugby, which is the politics behind it, is that, let's not be fooled, exactly like you said, Bayonne, their priority is not Europe. Their priority is to win every single game. Because what you have to understand is when the game gets postponed and their club gets shut, the boys can't play. How quick do you lose match fitness by staying in your house and, you know, jumping on the rowing machine whilst doing puzzles with your kids? It's pretty quick, right? I mean, it's so that's complicated. So even though you're allowed to play next week, yeah, fantastic. But that means they're not going to be the full Bayonne side. Like you said, they need absolutely everything to stay up, to keep their project going and all that. No problem. But they're also, the politics behind it is that the world of rugby is going to be transformed in the next couple of seasons, right? I mean, we've sort of addressed it from time to time, private equity investments. And I just saw that there's apparently another private equity company that's going to take 15% of the ABs. A shit ton of money is going to be chucked into
world rugby. Huge money.
Huge money. I think it was $1.3 billion valuation and they're taking 15%. Boom, fa. And so basically it's like, you know that something's going to change and there's not too many dates. And from the start, what I've told you is that top 14 are like, oh yeah, when they talked about, you know, aligning the calendars, if they want to touch the top 14, it's going to be war. Well, this is precisely the same thing. They basically see it as, is Europe or is us? So the reason why they want to jam pack this top 14 is that, imagine we get to the end of the season, at the speed at which it's going, there's going to be what? Some teams might have six games that they need to play. How the hell do you decide to say, you know, out of those six games, do you deserve to win, to lose, by bonus, not by bonus, whatever? So you can pretty much decide who's going to be qualified or not in the little boardroom by deciding, do you allocate points or not? And they don't want to get there, because then the broadcaster might be like, oh, listen, I paid 100 million for 100 games. So it's a tough, tough one. The last thing they want is to end up in this. So they're like, let's get rid of Europe and let's at least use those two weekends to do it. When things are shit, it's back to a little bit of self-isolation, of looking only at your front door.
Self-preservation.
Absolutely. And they're like, but what pisses me off is that it goes back to the same thing, that they're not even allowing a little bit of change. Europe are not perfect. They're far from being perfect. And we need to address this whole Toulon Scarlets thing, which at the time, I didn't really know what was going on and actually felt bad for everyone because I wanted the game to happen. But I can't believe that the EPCR guy, the French guy, Vincent Gaillard, then came out saying, the game was clean. I can't believe they did this. And then you actually go into the details. Some Toulon boys rock up at the stadium and some Welsh guys are telling us, oh, mate, yeah, we've got seven cases. It's not great.
Mental.
And then they're going to be forced to play. And that's 5 days before Christmas, right? you have to think about the guys as being human beings. If you're going to have the chance to spend Christmas with, well, it's not the case in England, but in France, if you have the chance to spend with your in-laws or with your parents or this and that, the last thing, I don't care about catching it, but the last thing I want in the world is to give it to somebody who's vulnerable. You know, so you got to think about them. You got to be like, all right. And then when they dig even deeper, you realize they got tested once during that week. That's it. So that's what really pissed me off about this whole thing is literally, like we've said it from the start, right? Everybody needs to get tested all the time.
On the politics in France, though, obviously there is a timing issue because it wasn't announced until Monday afternoon. So first of all, could it have been done earlier? I know things are fast developing, but could it have been done sooner than sort of 4 days before a team was supposed to play on the Friday? And then you mentioned, obviously it came from the French government, but then you mentioned the clubs having different motivating factors. How involved were the clubs in this? Did it come just from the government or was there an aspect of the clubs being involved as well?
So I don't know how linked it is, but I know that 100%, for instance, like Philippe Taieb, who's a special character at the best of times, the president of Bayonne, he had no interest in this European stuff going ahead. They don't have any interest. So they've been pushing and leaning on top 14 LNR. And then obviously it's caught wind and it's come, the government side is coming out and backed them. But there's, like we talked about, there's different agendas. Half of the clubs in the top 14 don't want to play European Cup. They have no interest. The Challenge Cup, they have absolutely no interest. Conversely, teams like Clermont, Benji, you know, Finewell, Racing, they'll be desperate to play. So I think half the clubs are going to be over the moon. The other clubs are going to be really disappointed, but it's come from both directions. There's absolutely one half the clubs that have got no interest and have pushed straight from the get-go to get these games off. So I'd say both. And to answer your question, could it have been done sooner? Potentially, but I think like everybody's learning, like it's a process. I think we'd see in the UK, we see in France, we see globally, week by week, things are changing. Restrictions are getting tougher in different countries. The UK now is completely different. Like France is completely free. We can do pretty much whatever we want. That's not to say that the second strain isn't going to arrive and things are going to change. But I think governments, governing bodies are moving week by week and learning and honestly flying by the seat of their pants. I don't know if you think any differently, but they don't know any better than us. And everybody's just trying to do the best job they can. But it's just unprecedented, weird times. But I do think it's great that they've got the top 14 games back on, whereas Premiership Rugby haven't done that.
I totally agree with you, Johnny. But just to answer your question, after that Bayonne-Leicester incident, like Johnny said, Taieb was absolutely fuming. It wasn't just a game that got cancelled. The whole club was forced to shut, right? The whole Bayonne rugby, professional rugby entity was forced to lock the door and, you know, to put a seal on it and be like, you guys stay home, do not move. Where, like Johnny said, in France, people are allowed to, with restrictions, with a curfew, with being careful and stuff, they're still allowed to live. They were completely shut, even the back office and everyone, you know, like the whole entity. And so he got really, really pissed off about this, considering that it was bit given, put on him. And like Johnny said, because they don't, it's not their priority and they clearly want to survive in top 14 first. He said, if things stay like this, I am not, even if we reopen in January, I am not playing the European Cup anymore. Stade Français pretty much said the same thing. So this kicked up a massive fuss. Then there was a meeting, just the EPCR and the league. They pretty much agreed, actually, to up that the testing policy of the EPCR to what is done in France. So basically three times a week. It's twice a week if everything's okay, three times a week if there's a problem. So it's on the Monday, just after the game, and then tested again on the Wednesday, or is it 48 hours before the game? Or I can't remember what it is.
72, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so once that's done, that basically sparkled a little interest from somebody else. But what happened for this time, which is completely different, it's the first time it's the Minister of Sport of France, not rugby in general. They just said European traveling or, you know, any sporting event against a particularly the United Kingdom teams has to stop. That's what they said. So it's the first time that it's the government who's basically leaning in and be like, listen. And that's why everybody then was like, oh, it's no more of the politics or, oh, it's the league, I'm the federation. No, I'm EPCR. It's me. I've got bigger balls than you do. No, it's the Minister of Sport who rocked up. He's like, listen, this is much bigger than everything else. And let's stop. And I think what saves the Six Nations is that the first game is Italy-France, right? Or France-Italy. Yeah. So there's no traveling into the UK. There's no traveling to England or to Ireland until the Ireland-France game, which is then will be end of Feb or something. So that's the only thing, is giving a few weeks of breathing space to then figure out what's going on. But so that's the reason why, to answer your question, Tim, it could have not been done before, because it's the first time the Minister of Sport rocks up. Is like, listen, let's press pause now. We decide, and that's how it's going to be.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And the top 14 is back. You mentioned it, Johnny. And there's been a bit of news, hasn't there? So you predicted it on this show a while back. Garbajosa, he's gone from Montpellier.
He is, mate. But the writing was on the wall for so long. From murmurs within the club, from people that worked with him, and results, they were just, I don't know, they were dreadful for so long. When you think about the raw ingredients and what they've got, their team, Arthur Vincent, Andre Pollard, who's injured just now, Louis Picamol, they've got one of the best squads in the top 14 and it just hasn't clicked. So called it a while ago, but not surprised. And being replaced obviously with Philippe Saint-André, and you've worked with him, Benji. I don't know if he's the best guy to come in and do the on-field stuff in terms of actual coaching and, no, I didn't think so either. So it's a strange one for Montpellier. And I just feel as well, there's been so many coaches come through the doors and try to change things. I feel like so many people have persuaded Moed Altrad that they could be the person to take the club to the next level, but it's just never happened. And yeah, really, it's just strange. It's a strange club, strange times. It ticks all the boxes, should be wonderful, but it just hasn't worked. So be interested to get our guest on and catch his thoughts on it because he's much closer to it than we are.
You teed it up nicely, Johnny. Our guest should be able to give us a little bit of insight into the situation in Montpellier, hopefully. So let's get him on now. It's former Montpellier coach and Scotland and British and Irish Lions second row, Nathan Hines, joins us. How are you?
Very well, gents. How are we?
We're good. We're good. So just fill us in. Where are you now? Where are you living? What are you up to?
I'm in beautiful Cheshire. Well, not so beautiful. I went for a run this morning. It was hosing down, but that's pretty much every day. Lockdown, homeschooling, Zooming, like everyone else. So just adapting to everything. But happy to be back in the UK. The kids are happy to be back at an English-speaking school. And so it's all good.
You mentioned you went for a run. Has Johnny got you signed up for Doddy Aid, putting the miles in?
Johnny tried to recruit me, but there's no way I'm joining his team.
What?
I mean, Team South, obviously, because I'm from Gala.
Mate, you're the biggest nomad I've ever met. You're 100% Team Exile. There's nobody more Team Exile than you.
Mate, when I first came to Scotland, I was at Gala and they embraced me and I embraced the culture and I couldn't join any other team.
It couldn't be anything to do with the fact that you've seen the stats as well, Nathan, and you realise that Johnny's team is lagging behind quite a bit.
Well, Johnny knows me as a player and a coach and I've never looked at a stat in my life. So, but no, Team South. Not just to support Doddy, but yeah, I think Jim and Johnny are on the Exile team as well. Are you on the Exile team, Johnny?
Yep.
Head of recruitment, no less.
But why aren't you in the Glasgow team? Are you ashamed of that?
No, not at all. I'll always be part of Glasgow, but I think right now my current situation, Nathan, very, very much in exile. Plus, I think they were absolutely bombing and they were trying to drag in anyone they could, and that was it. They were happy to have me, so...
That was the reason why you tried to recruit me. You're bombing. You tried to recruit anyone you could.
Mate, I'm just trying to help a struggling ship. And in the end, we're raising money for a fantastic charity. So it shouldn't matter.
Exactly.
I don't know why we're fighting.
No, we're not. We're not fighting, really, are we? We're just bickering like brothers, aren't we?
Like teammates. Nothing's changed.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm in Team South also, Nathan.
Oh, you're just confused. You're confused is what you are.
Hang on. Let me finish because I got recruited by Rory Lawson. So I don't care about where we are. I think we're all, you know, brothers of humanity.
And so when he asked me to do it, I joined because I know he's going to run 15 miles a day so I can do my 500 yards and I'll feel a chip in.
The shots. You know,
and it's all good. I count the steps going up and down to grab a coffee from this two-story high house. I think I should get a star for that.
I completely agree that we're all doing a great job, Johnny, but it doesn't say a lot for your title as head of recruitment that neither Nathan or Benji are on your team.
They'd already signed up, mate. It's a lost cause.
Anyway, speaking of recruitment, before we got you on, Nathan, we were talking about Montpellier and Xavier Garbajosa leaving the club. And obviously you were there and you overlapped with him slightly. So just give us your take on the situation.
I mean, it was not surprising seeing the results that they had. So it was a bit of an awkward one, really, because he was recruited with Pepe Le Fon, who came in at the same time. Pepe left the club as well 2 months ago. And just, I think, after a string of bad results and the president, Ultrad, just decided that the only thing he could do was to let Xavier go.
Hey, take us back a step, because obviously you arrived at the same time as Vern. You finished top at the top 14. You lost the final against Cast. You were absolutely flying. You pretty much won every game at home. You were killing it. Go back to before Garbajosa. Why was Vern let go?
It's a long story which starts. So we killed it in year one, most trials I think in top 14, and we won all our home games. Got to the final, crapped the bed, and Cast beat us. And Benji, we know about Cast, how they can just lip their way to the final, and like they beat us at home. My last game at Claremont, they beat us at home in the barrage, which was the only time I lost at Marcel Michelin.
That was the game where we lost the record of 77 home consecutive home wins at Marcel Michelin. They're the team to do it.
That was it. And we were absolutely poo that day. And that,
yeah.
But they just know how to play finals footy. And that's what they did against us. They barred up and smashed us. So in that second season, before the season started, so Cast's our first game after losing to them in the final. It's everyone, you know, it's Canal Plus's dream to have the finalists play. And the president has a presentation for us on the Thursday, basically asking us why we lost the game the year before against Cast. And the president says, lads, what's going on here? Why are you so rubbish? And then obviously we lost against Cast at home in game one. And what the catalyst was for the president, I think, was that we played a game against Perpignan at home. Perpignan had won a game because they got promoted in the top 14. Right. They hadn't won a game all year, and they beat us, which is obviously an amazing place to be as a coach.
As an assistant coach, you just sat back a little bit like, oh.
No, not really. I mean, because the scrum got pumped. And the boys were looking. We had a meeting in the change room after the president was there, and he's like, guys, what's going on? But in the background, I think the president is, you know, he has got a lot of cash, obviously, and he's got all his advisors and he listens to people. And I just think that he knows a lot about business, but takes advice about rugby. And I don't know how or why, but he just lost faith in Vern, I suppose, or just starting to get the ball rolling and seeing if he could bring someone else to help steady the ship, whether that was someone that's given that advice or not. Like I don't know, but he's pretty impatient, the president, so he wants results quickly. And I think that's been a bit of a problem for Montpellier. You know, you play there, Johnny, you know. So he wants to win the championship and he wants to win it pretty quickly. But I think that was the catalyst. The Prez got the ball rolling on finding a replacement for bring someone in. I don't think it was to replace Vern, but make Vern, in his head, director of rugby, bring someone in who turned out to be Xavier. But what happened in the meantime between that game and end of the season is that we went on a really good winning streak where we finished 11 wins from 13 remaining games, and we finished on the last day beating Claremont at home, or Claremont in Claremont, which we're the only team that year to do it. And Cast lost at home that day, so we went and played a barrage at Lyon. Subsequently, we got pumped. we had nothing in the tank. Basically, we were playing a final every week for the last 3 months, so 3 or 4 months. But, you know, I think after a difficult start to the season, we managed to pull it back. And I'm pretty sure the president didn't think that we were capable, or players were capable of doing it, and we did. So obviously it's too late to pull out. Xavier was brought in with he was a forwards coach. I mean, obviously there was a year left to go, and he brought in Pepe Le Font and Xavier came in year three.
Yeah, but I love, like, obviously I've been there as well, and what I get with Moed is you've obviously got this man with incredible wealth, incredible amount of business ability, acumen, get up and go and start. He's a lovely bloke as well.
Yeah.
But you can't be let in a room to talk about rugby. Like, he did it two or three times when I was there, and you just want to, no, just stop him. Somebody, I know he's the president, but just somebody stop him getting in the room, because he just kills it. He flattens everything. He's got no idea of rugby culture or how to talk or rugby people. And it's horrendous. And I don't know, just everything at Montpellier, it could be one of the best clubs in Europe.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's got everything to draw people to it. It's got wealth. It's got a fantastic stadium. It's a beautiful place to live. It's got the beach. But just, I don't know, you get there and it's just the infrastructure, or there's an off vibe, or you feel like there's something dubious or underhand going on, and you never quite get your finger on it. And then obviously you have every 2 years, somebody come in and try and pull the wool over Moed's eyes and make him believe that he is the messiah and he can win the top 14. And it just is a constant circle and a nasty cycle.
That's the thing. I mean, I think if he just settled on a coach or a staff that could have some sort of continuity and you know, make it that the players, so what you're saying, people aren't safe there really, because before even, but when I left the SA, Scotland, Vern and I got there early. Alex King and Ian Vass they came a little bit later. So we watched the barrage for the previous year. They're racing at home, they got beat. But what had happened as well, there were some players that we didn't want in our squad. The GIF quota was changing, the salary cap and all that. So we knew there was players that were leaving. The president hadn't told them. No one had told them. So they had...
I know this story. This is awesome. Go, Wagga. Yeah. This is great.
Mate, it's not awesome if you're a player, mate. And it's not awesome if you're a coach coming in. The president didn't want to tell them. I don't know if Jake White wanted to tell them, if it was his decision, which, yeah, it does make a difference, really. So we watched the barrage on Saturday. And then the president said, we're going to have a meeting on Monday afternoon to introduce you and Nathan to the team before they go on holiday. We didn't know that none of the players that weren't going to be there the next year hadn't been told yet. So the players had a barbecue organised for the Monday, and it got out in the press about players leaving or being let out of their contracts. And some of the players were having food, and they were looking at the phones going, mate, what's going on here? And then they're going on. And then they got a tap on the shoulder from the director general at the time and said, oh, can we have a chat? So obviously it sort of blew up then, that the players found in the press that they were being let go. And like you're saying, Johnny, it just has no, I mean, rugby, you know, is feeling in rugby, you know, there's managing people, and we're most people, you know, have that respect where I'm honest. Honestly, you tell me how it is and then we can get over it. But mate, that was quite tough. So I remember getting to the stadium, I think it would have been about 3 o'clock. Obviously boys living in their cars, and then basically the shit hit the fan. And then the president had a meeting with the players, and Vern and I are there. He's introducing us. And one of the most awkward meetings I've ever been in my life, where guys have just been told to leave. They're not coming back to the club, and they're not knowing this months in advance where they could find a club. They've just been told, boys, you're not coming back. The remaining players are really annoyed that they've been told the way they have been. And they're pissed off with the president. And the president goes, okay, boys, so that's happened. We're moving on next year. He's these two coaches. I'm going to talk to you. So it was awkward. It was really awkward.
But that's the lack of empathy.
That's empathy.
So rugby, everywhere in the world, rugby talks about values, culture, a sort of unwritten code, trust that we have with each other. And that is just, that's one of the things that we haven't gone into yet in the podcast. Benji, I can see your head and your hands. You're going to love this. But it's one thing that in other parts of the world is slightly more respected, or there's a bit more respect for players. Whereas because it's so businesslike, because it's presidents that have big companies and they're very much used to, how can you say this, almost transactional leadership. right, I pay this guy off, he gets his payout, he should be sweet. But that's not the way it is. There's an effect and there's an emotions behind these things that have a ripple effect and a butterfly effect on everyone in the squad, their feeling, the vibe, and then how that club is viewed by all other teams. And that's it. Montpellier is just one of those teams for one reason or another. And there's a few of them in France that has that. And it's that, for me, it's transactional leadership. Oh, you know, I've paid him off in June. Like, he's going to get his full year contract. He should be happy. Mate, no, he's got a wife. He's got three kids. They have a house that they've bought here. They're happy. He has to now find the club or continue playing. His, like, Antoine Batut's a good example. He was one of the blokes. Yeah. Wife, two kids, has to find a club and find a team and a job in 3 months. Otherwise, he's forcibly retired effectively because you can't find a team. And who wants a bloke that hasn't played for a year? And it's just mental. Like, Benji, I want to chuck this to you because I can see you're gagging to get in.
No, but we spoke about Marvin O'Connor already. Remember, he got sacked three times, yes, three consecutive clubs, and he got three-year
deals.
And the big answer from all those Moed Altrad is like, why are you going to complain? I just wrote you a check for 150 grand, 200 grand, whatever it is. You know, dry your eyes and move on. Well, I know this is fun, and Heinze, you were in the middle of it, and I'm sure at the time you were not laughing at all because that is heartbreaking shit. But it really, really pisses me off to hear that again and again, because how long ago? That was 3 years ago, right? When Vern was there. And he's just repeatedly, and he's the same guy that was in a lawsuit with Fabien Galthié for 2.5 years and ended up paying it off for a couple
and
of
years. And then Jake White, and like, never ending.
Wow, Jake White should have never been there, in my opinion, but that's just my opinion. But basically, it's just, what pisses me off is that it's repeatedly the same thing, you know? And it's really, this is crushing my soul in terms of beautiful place. There's a huge academy that you forgot to mention that brings some fantastic players out that are really, really good. There's a really, how do you say, proud region around the club and the values that it gives and stuff. And there's a really strong legacy, you know, from the past of this cool club that came back from, I mean, the Louis Picamol era of those guys that came from second division, the Fufu Drago and all that, and brought this club back to where it should be. Then you bring one of the biggest French businessmen success of the last decade, who should be there, not only because he has got a lot of cash, obviously, but he definitely knows a few things about business, right? You can't take that away from him. But then when a guy like that can make so many mistakes repetitively. Again, then, I mean, don't get me into launch into this, but dips his fingers with the Federation in the most dodgy way you could possibly think. You know, that really allegedly, obviously. But, you know, and really puts, I don't think these guys realize the shadow that it puts on the whole of French rugby. It's not just Montpellier. It just makes us look like idiot, because you make the players only be money driven, because you're like, oh, listen, if they didn't kick much more of a storm and actually burn the club down, that means all they care is about their welfare. Yes, but when you turn around and your missus is like, well, what are we doing next year? And she's mortified. Then you pull the check out. You're like, listen, we'll be all right for a couple of months. Don't worry. You know, we can sort the kids out. We're not jumping off a cliff right now. And that's, you got to know that the guys have got to take care of their own ones, right? Then you got Heinze. You're gonna be like, oh, but they let go Vern. How could you possibly do that? But you're in the same wheel. You got to work. You got to keep on going. We got to make out of the best out of a shitty situation. So basically, I think really do think it's like you let the wolf into the den, or I don't know how you say that. You know, le parc aux agneaux. And then and we're just letting those mistakes be done. You know, you're just letting those mistakes be repeated all the time. And I mean, listen, Heinze, I played with you in Clermont. We had a great time, and Vern was there, and we were not perfect in Clermont by a mile, not by a mile, but at least you could walk in and speak to Vern. You could walk in, speak to the president at the time. You could speak to Jean-Marc Lhermé, I think it was at the time. And you knew you were going to have an honest answer, right? You knew there wasn't going to be any backstabbing about, listen, you know, shut your mouth now. We forget about who you are. We forget about how many kids you've got. We forget about what you've done in your life. And we're just going to chuck you out the window. It's not perfect at all, but there's a tiny bit more respect that actually makes me feel a little bit more warm inside about recommending rugby to other people. I mean, you've got sons. Waga, you know, recommending them to go play in Montpellier in 10 years' time. Right now, you're like, oh, stay somewhere else, you know?
Well, it's a couple of things, Benji. Like, I think for rugby players as well, you can't be half in. You can't be half into playing. The sport's hard enough as it is, right? So if constantly you feel like you've got a red dot on you, you're not going to invest yourself emotionally or physically into your club. I mean, the president brought in Johan Goosen, who's a good bloke, but we had to get rid of two players to fit him in the salary cap, two players that were that we wanted to keep because they're really good for the squad. But obviously we're forced to do that because the president's listened, had some advice and brought him in, or even, you know, that's a whole nother story about Goose and Racing 92.
Get into it. That's a great one. Come on. Yeah, give us the depth on that one because everyone really wants to know.
I don't know the story on that one, mate.
Oh, mate.
No, I don't know the story on that one. That was done, I think that would have been done before we were there. But the funny thing is, a bit of a story, is on that, when we played Racing 92, start of the season, in my third year, they welcomed, in the change room, they welcomed back former racing players, and Goose's name wasn't on there. Well, obviously, I wrote it up because that was quite rude. But
you're so awkward, man.
Yeah, I am. It's just me, mate. You know,
I know.
Just be a pain in the neck, and then so obviously they're still a little bit sore about that. But going back to the emotional security thing is as well. Like, I think that's a problem. If you kind of keep repeating the cycle, Benji, like you're saying, you know, you get a coach in, you get rid of him, you get another coach in. Jake White, it came in. He decimated the academy at Montpellier. We got there and there was like zero players. There was no players whatsoever. All the good players from Montpellier playing all the clubs in top 14 now. And they're amazing. He came in, he brought in South Africans to bump up. That was a different time with the salary cap and the GIF, which caught up to us when we started. It just, like you say, it's a great place. It could be an amazing club, but no one invests themselves fully because they're just fearful of that transactional leadership saying, I paid you for this, you do this. If you don't do it, then leave.
Johan Goosen, to sum up the situation, was a racing player, decided to do the dodgiest thing possible, fly back to South Africa, pretend that I'm retiring from professional rugby, whatever, to get out of a long-term deal to sign somewhere else. Yeah. Even Bujelal and Lorenzetti, who are not the cleanest blokes in the world, said the club who will sign Johan Goosen is led by a thief, is led by a mob. You know, yeah. And then all of a sudden you see Montpellier boom, 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 coming through and they signed him. And how did they do it? I think they must have paid him in Safa for a while and then get him to come back. Whatever they did, like you said, that's like, that will be part of a good book in a couple of seasons. But that's the impact that it's got, like you said, to shine back onto the lack of trust in the whole organization. Because, you know, if you're part of the club that does that, you're like, oh, shit, it's us again. If you know that the president comes out a statement saying, Nathan Heiss has got nothing to worry about his job, you know, he'll be fine. And 3 weeks later, he's sacked. That's what he did to Garbajosa, right? After
he did it to Werner as well.
And he did the same thing to Werner. So that VC, you cannot trust. So my question is, there's zero trust from the players to the president, for sure. So like you said, they're le cul entre deux chaises, the ass between two seats. They don't know where they're going. You know, they're a bit scared. And obviously that impacts their full commitment to the team, to give your soul and your passion and your heart every week in, week out, for sure. But does it also shine on you guys as a management, as a coaching squad? Because you're basically the link between the president and the players, right? Does that prevent from the players to actually trusting in trusting the coaching setup because they were above or not? Because let's face it, Montpellier has always been a tough place to play, right? It's not been about physicality. Physicality has never been the problem. But you could just tell that there was just that little bit of thing that wasn't clicking, apart from what you mentioned, that last stretch of season where you end up beating Clermont in Clermont for my last game in Clermont. Thank you very much. And then you lost in the barrage against Lyon. And you had you needed like consecutive wins just to fit in. And I remember Mohamed Awas, the French prop, scoring a try at 81st minute against Stade Français, who got you a bonus point.
Oh, mate, it was ridiculous. It was a ridiculous story.
And then there's a kickoff and he picks it up and he scores last minute. And then you get that bonus point that allows you to score. So that's when I felt there was a bit of glue in that squad. And so my question is, does that lack of glue, is it impacted? Is the relationship coaching players, is it as impacted as president players?
No, I think what Vern did really, really well is he served as a barrier between the president and the players. He said, look, boys, we are rugby. The president is the president. He said, we have to look after one thing, and that's us. And whatever happens outside is what happens outside. We can't do it. So, and Vern, even as a coaching group, Vern absorbed a lot of shit from the prez that we didn't even know about. So he did a lot of work just being that buffer between everyone. But I think the reason why we came back like that is because we, as a group, playing and coaching group, we respected each other and we knew that there was a good relationship between us. I mean, it was brutal at times and always honest, as you know, Benji being coached and Beats being coached by Vern. But I think that the investment the players had with us was different than how they feel with the Prez.
How is Vern?
Mate, he's in New Zealand. He's in COVID-free New Zealand on the farm. So, mate, he's amazing.
Can you actually see Vern coaching Fiji? I think either he's going to have a heart attack, either he's going to kill one of them, but something's going to happen. Or he might be the first coach to actually transform them into a hell of a side.
I think he's changed a lot since he first came to Claremont, Benji, but still very intense. And I think the good thing about VC as well, he understands the culture of where he goes. So he learns a lot. He likes to read and be informed about, you know, the culture of Claremont or Scottish history, Scottish culture, the Montpellier and Fiji. Obviously, Fiji's got a massive culture. So I think he makes a real effort to understand the people that he coaches. And I think it's good for him as well that it's international. So it's not week on week. But he loves coaching. And I was part of the coaching group on the successful Barbas tour.
I was going to bring that up, yeah.
No losses.
At some point, if you're part of the shit every time, Wagga, you got to look at yourself, mate.
Don't worry, Benji. Every day. That's another story. We'll get into that later. But Vern will be really, he'll do really well in engaging with them and upskilling them and getting them to play decent rugby. So I'm happy that he's got the job.
Mate, you touched on something really interesting with Vern, and it's the psychological aspect. Like, I would say he's weird. Like, most people that have been coached by Vern would say he's a weird guy, but he's a good guy. He's a straight guy, but he's a little bit weird. And it's the psychological aspect. I love that. The way he came into Scotland and he'd be like, no, boys, like, obviously, because it's a tiny, there's like Glasgow, Edinburgh, your little bubble. Your strength is that you know each other. You tap into the fact that you're clans and you know, like, he was really good and adept at mentally getting involved with whatever squad he had and bringing the best out, using different things. That's what I loved about Vern. He also nearly broke me though, in that you said psychologically, he is tough, but psychologically there's different ways of dealing with different people. And I remember, I think it was my second last Six Nations game, I think he did break me actually. I think he was the last coach to pick me and he was the last one. But we were in the tunnel and he was like, oh, Beats, can you come in here and we'll just have a chat. And he took me into, you know, in the tunnel at Murrayfield, you've got all the names and everyone's caps. And then there's that little like boot room where the coaches change their boots before you go out into team run.
It was change room three.
And he pulled me in there. This is my second last game, Six Nations for Vern. He's like, is there any chance you could watch Fritz Lee and play a bit more like him? And that was it. He obviously was so, or he wasn't getting what he wanted. He was just like, mate, if you could watch Sergio Parise or Fritz Lee and just try and be a bit more like them in the way you play, like, I'd really appreciate it. That was it. Two games later, never seen again. Thanks for coming, Vern. Thanks for having me. Man, he absolutely broke me.
He's definitely got his own management style, mate. I was speaking to my mum the other day and I told her about Xavier and stuff. He said that, you know, it was good. He helped you, you know, build your confidence. I said, Mum, Vern didn't help me build my confidence. Vern made me build my own confidence, because that's the way he does stuff, you know. He's brutally honest and he does it from a place of love and, well, most of the time. But everything he does is what he thinks is the best for the team. And that's, you know, sometimes it's hard to hear. I mean, brutal.
Brutal, mate.
Coaches' meetings were brutal as well. Mate, you think you had it tough as a player. Different gravy when you're one of his assistants. But the thing is, he just wants you to be better. He wants the team to be better. And that's just the way he does it. So, but like, you're going back to the story thing, I think he just tries to find the identity of the squad, the team, whoever he's coaching, tries to tie it in with the history of where you are. And I think that gives everyone a higher purpose and gives everyone in the squad you know, sense of something bigger than themselves. And I've got videos that our analysts put together when we're with Scotland, just about Scotland, you know, and about being Scottish. And it makes you cry every time you watch it, because you just have that feeling. And it doesn't matter if it's what video it is or where you are, that emotional lever is something that Vern's really good at.
And mate, also, I was going to say, the feeling you got, even though he didn't really enjoy me much as a player, which I understand, you can't be everyone's cup of tea.
You're not Fritz Lee, mate.
You're not my cup of tea either, right?
No, not anyone's cup of tea. But you 100% got that vibe. Whereas I would have been really, I would have struggled to then have a coffee with him or have a glass of wine. But you two actually became really good mates, like on and off. Like you have a few glasses of red together, like you chill out together. You got on really well.
Yeah, we did. I don't know. I don't know how it came about, really. I didn't spend any time outside of rugby with him when I was at Claremont, Benji, apart from one time, after the cast game, he invited me around to his house and said, mate, where did we go wrong?
We had two 52-year-olds in the locks, but mate, they were hanging in there. So they weren't really there Monday, Tuesday, but by Saturday, they were there and they're properly there.
Mate,
so
you're full of shit. We're lucky. I had the orange card that Vern used to come in. He goes, mate, you want an orange card today? You get your, I know you're old. You don't want to play. You know, and I'm trained here. And like, I'm like, and obviously he knows that he says anything like, you can't do that. I'm like, well, yes, I can. So every, I think I missed two trainings. I had a broken toe that I had to get an injection for to train because I couldn't walk without it. But he's like, mate, you just stay in. You and Jumon can stay.
He does that all the time.
I know.
He does that all the time.
But he's poking you, mate. He's poking you, but which works for some people and doesn't with others, but definitely worked with me. And then, but yeah, we did have a few glasses of wine, we had barbecues and stuff, and he was good at we had the staff came around to his house and got people together and stuff, so he's not as weird as probably you think he is, Beats. He's just he didn't want to talk to you.
I don't blame him, mate.
He's really close to Fritz Lee though.
I don't blame him either.
Yeah, had him around a couple of times.
You've spent most of the last 10 years with him, with Vern, Nathan. So has he tried to take you to Fiji or not?
No, mate. No, he hasn't. So obviously he's learned that I'm a crap at coaching. So that's why I don't do it anymore. No, he's got some good assistants. So way better than me. I've spoken to him, obviously on the Fiji, the Barbarians trip, as short as it was. But yeah, nothing to do with Fiji.
How gutting was that trip, the Barbarians trip, and the way it all unfolded? And
oh, mate, it's just disappointing, really, wasn't it? I mean, we all signed up to the week in the rubbish hotel that we were staying with and drinking together in the team room. You know, we signed up for that. And then, you know, it's just disappointing that the players felt the need to go outside of the hotel. So disappointed for the guys, the Fijian guys who... The first time out of Fiji, mate. They come to London, play a game against England, and they get told they can't play. So no, it was really gutted for them. But yeah, it was a bit. The thing is, we were lucky to be able to have that game on. Lucky to for these guys to be here, and it's just, I think just disappointing is the word, mate. I'm not angry, disappointed. It's just one of those dead ones. But yeah, it was the other thing that really made it. Difficult for me to watch, especially when I saw the video on Twitter, is that the boys are having a great time, like having drinking games and stuff. But that would have been awesome if it was in the hotel. Yeah, but it would have been better if it was in a hotel. You know, like, why couldn't we have done it there? You normally sneak out of the hotel because you want a beer and the coaches don't let you. But when you're on the bar bars and you say, boys, let's get stuck in the beers and have a chat, you know, that's the disappointing thing as well.
And you've given us a good insight into what Vern is like as a bloke. Presumably he laid the rules of the bubble out to everyone very clearly. How did he take it?
Yeah, he was bitterly disappointed like myself. I mean, he didn't, the Barbas made it very clear before you turned up the rules and regulations. And Monday they got told exactly what was happening. So Vern's an early sleeper, especially as a bit jet lagged from New Zealand. So I was up when the security guard told me the boys had been out. So I was like, oh God, I had to put my poker hand down and get up from the poker table and sort this out. But yeah, so we had to go wake him up, and he thought we were joking at the start because he would never have thought that that would happen either. You know, you put your trust in people and you think that they'd be able to follow through. Obviously, we had to try and get 12 players, as it turned out, with 13, but 12 players on the Thursday before the game to replace the 12 that had been out. We managed to do that, and we found out there was another player that, there are a few on the Thursday, so they couldn't on the Friday, so they couldn't do it because it was too much of a risk. But you know, we had to pull it together, and I think that after that effort, the second effort to get everyone back, get the players that had to leave back in was, I think he was just really disappointed that he couldn't give the opportunity for the guys who managed to stay in the hotels and follow the rules.
We've drifted quite a long way from Xavier Garbajosa there, but going back to your relationship with him, when you left Montpellier, obviously you did overlap with him for a while. You've spoken publicly about how, you know, you weren't compatible as maybe as blokes, but definitely as coaches. So just give us an insight into how it all unfolded with you leaving and what your relationship was like with him.
I mean, from the start, we had a camp in Tignes and we drove up. It's difficult. So we knew it was a bit of a shit sandwich that Xavier and Pepe were coming in. We knew we had 1 year left. We knew Vern had been moved upstairs, but we're like, okay, well, this is a situation we're in. Let's just do this because, you know, it might not be that bad. He might be all right. All right, bloke, you might have some good ideas. And we've done a lot of work in the two previous years. We found out what worked, what didn't. We knew the players really well. And then we went up to Tignes. They left early. So Pepe and Xavier left early in a van. We drove up in vans. The coaches and the staff drove up in vans. They took one. They stopped off at Grenoble for lunch, which we found out at the end afterwards. And we got there and Pepe and Xavier were working on their game plan. And it was clear from the start that they were like, Xavier was trying to piss on his patch, which is fine. But we didn't really include us at the start, saying, well, boys, I can't say for it, but if it was me, I'd go in and say, and I'm going into two coaches that are already there. We're sort of a little bit gun shy because it's a bit of a crappy situation. You'd find out what worked, what didn't, try to make us, you know, bring us on side, manages the people and trying to get the best out of us, knowing that we're probably not going to be there in a year and he could use that to be better. Obviously, it didn't work out that way because he was like working on stuff and we tried to have a coaches meeting and it ended up being that they're telling us what we're going to be doing. And so it was pretty clear from the outset. And then there was not much bonding going on. I think we climbed up a mountain in Tignes and we come back down and this is the kind of thing, you know, we all know about rugby. Like, we do something hard, we have a beer together, like whether we're playing on the same team or on a different team. So we climbed this mountain, which was the team we're going to do, but we send them up in gondolas and the coaches, right? We said, we'll do it. Came back and went down to the cafe on the lake there. Right, boys, let's have a beer, you know. End of a hard day, it's been, and we all had beers. And I think Xavier had a Perrier and Pippi had a Coke, and you're like, oh, okay. And then he told the boys they couldn't go out for a beer after training. This is obviously pre-COVID, so that's when you could interact outside your room. So he said, and I'm like, oh, so it just became awkward right from the start. And we're like, okay, fine. Like, we could, maybe it's just because he's new and he doesn't really know us and stuff. But it didn't really get much better from there, to be fair.
Sounds crap.
Note to all the coaches out there, if you go to Tignes with your team, Tignes is in the French Alps, right? And there's a fantastic setup in the summer to train, fantastic facilities. When you go, definitely have a few beers. Remember the Clermont season 2 years ago where they were really shit after I left, obviously?
Oh, they're only shit when you left, mate. They were good when you were there.
they basically had the same issue. It was a big, long day. Frank was scared because a lot of leadership had left the team. There was a lot of youth within it. It was the World Cup year and all that. And after a big, massive week and stuff, there was there was a fete. There was a, what do you call that? Like a
festival,
a regional party, or I don't know. You know how you call that in Tignes every year. And that was in front of their hotel. And the boys were allowed one beer and then go back home. And that created frustration and this and that. Oh, you're not allowed. And, you know, we don't understand. We're not kids. And at the same time, once you train hard, you deserve your treat and all that. So basically, long story short, whenever anybody goes into a camp, if you want to build a team, I'm not saying get absolutely trashed, you know, and get absolutely mental, but allow your boys to have a few beers. It's a big part of rugby, right?
I think it is a big part of rugby. And that's Vassie and I, Ian Vass and I, like we went out that night and had a beer because to get to conversation, to relax. Like we didn't have to have a beer to talk, but, you know, just get out of the hotel and talk about the day. And it was pretty rubbish, mate, to be fair. And the boys sort of knew it. They knew the situation we're in anyway with new coaches coming in. But that was the hard bit for us. Well, Vassie ended up going to Northampton in November because he fell out with Xavier, because Xavier tried to change the defence system, and questioning Ian on his defensive system and trying to change it, where Ian's responsible for the defensive system. So if he, but then he had another opportunity in Northampton. So he left in November, leaving me on my Todd with three French coaches, which was amazing. And pretty much hating life. Ended up being, even when Vassie was there, talk about a racing game. It changed the way we did a boost before, you do your pre-match stuff, changed all that stuff. And Vassie and I didn't know. So we turned up at the thing and they're doing all this stuff. I'm like, mate, did you know anything about this? And they're like, no. So they had meetings then about changing the stuff that we didn't know about. Obviously, I found out that they had selection meetings without me and all sorts of stuff. So
that sucks.
It was pretty good.
But again, the proof is in the pudding. Obviously, he's been sacked, but his inability to co-work or think of the greater good and his fight to sort of micromanage or control, he's been sacked. So
yeah,
do you know what I mean? And the product that he came from La Rochelle, where with Patrice Collazo, they played from some fantastic rugby, but none of that shone through at Montpellier. So then what transferred onto training pitch was actually that anything that was seen to be good or perceived as productive from La Rochelle make its way over to Montpellier, or was it just something completely clean that he tried to do and just did not work?
It didn't work. I think he tried to play from everywhere. There's no real detail around staff. The best way to describe it is Toulouse 1995 or 2005. That's the way he wanted to play. Offloading, no rucks, that kind of stuff. But he just didn't have the team to do it. And rugby sort of changes. We didn't have the scrum to do it. You couldn't dominate in the scrum. We even have parity in the scrum, especially made errors in the first half. And there's just no strategy to a game. I mean, even like this, going back to the game against La Rochelle just a couple of weeks ago where they got beaten, the strategy was to play around them. They played in a hurricane. And they knew all week it was going to be wet, windy, it was going to be rubbish, and the strategy was play around them. And it's just a mistake. So we wanted success, and we could put their personal stuff aside, even though that it's difficult to work with people. You try and put that personal stuff aside just so we can win. And one of the lowlights for me was, I think it was about three games in, and had a meeting. I think we lost two lineouts in the attacking 22. And bearing in mind, I think we're second or third. Our lineout was quite good. Second or third, we're quite inventive. I think we lost two lineouts, and that really annoyed him, because obviously by the time we get to the 5 meter line of the lineout, we work so hard to get there because we've played for our own try line that he's expecting us to score a try. So we missed two lineouts in three games. He's like, right, this is shit. Nathan, you have to consult with Vern now. Everything you do has to go through him. Bearing in mind that Xavier told Vern he doesn't want anything to do with him because he doesn't want it's his team, and he wants him just to stay up in the office and not come back. So that was interesting dynamic as well. He came down with the coaches' meetings every now and then at the start, but then couldn't come back at the end. So he said, run everything through Vern. Vern's going to make all the decisions, but you can still have the pleasure of talking to the players. Oof. I didn't really know how to react, and then I let it go, and then I was like, that's just wrong. So that's just the kind of thing. I didn't really enjoy him as a human. I didn't think we definitely weren't compatible as coaches, and it was pretty bad time. So everything, but, I forgot to say about the Savonnet La Fonche. So that's the disappointing for me, the thing that the president said about the assistant coaches that were in place when Xavier came along, that we set him up for a fall, which was a bit disappointing, because we said that to the president that we were quite happy to work with him for the best of the team, but there's no way we weren't doing anything that was not for the best of the team. So I think as people, Vassie and I, Marty, the analyst, that's not against, as it goes against who we are and what we would do, but that was a disappointing thing because it wasn't the case.
Before Form Wed to say that, that's obviously come back to him.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Garbajosa.
Now, in the same time, you could see with Galtier. Remember, in the whole lawsuit, he said, "I asked Fabien Galtier to
do me an explanation, to write me a report on the explanation why the team wasn't doing well. So, okay. Then he did the same thing with Vern. I asked Vern to actually address me in a PowerPoint presentation or to send me a report about why is the team blah, 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 blah. And then same thing that you mentioned earlier in the chat. I asked Xavier this and that. So basically, I think he's only doing it to cover his ass legally. In case there's a lawsuit, he wants to be like, listen, I have actually asked him to, he did not produce it. That's it. Remember, because that's the excuse he got for sacking Xavier. He said, I sat with Philippe Saint-André and Xavier, asked them to produce a report. They didn't. You know, so he's only trying to do this. So basically, long story short, I think it's, he's just trying to cover his ass, right?
And I don't really care what they say anyway, because the thing is that you got to be comfortable with what you do, who you are, and what you put into anything you do. And I know, and Vassi know that, mate, we did everything we could to make that team successful, copping all the shit from Xavier and the president. And, you know, I like the president, but, you know, some of the stuff that he does cause you problems. But, mate, I'm not really bothered about the comments because I know the truth, so...
So going back to better times, anyway, better times, let's talk about your playing days briefly, because you obviously moved over to France and you were successful with Perpignan and you won the top 14. But there's a story there, isn't it? Because you left there because you went on the British and Irish Lions tour. You couldn't play in the final, the last stage of the season. So just talk us through what happened there.
So the year before, so 2008, was Christophe Pourcu. He led this huge... remontada, I don't know how you'd say that, a comeback for Perpignan. They had basically a camp in the mountains. Benji wasn't teen, it was Matamal, I think. And they got on the steam and came together. They had a fight against Stade Francais, and that was a catalyst for coming back and getting into the finals that year. So we played Clermont in Marseille, and it was 36 degrees. Jacques Brunel was a coach at the time. He put me on the bench. I was raging. I was raging. Vern was coaching for Clermont against us that day. And it was probably the first time I met him, actually. And he's like, mate, why didn't they pick you? So I was still a little bit bitter from that, really, from being benched and being pumped by Clermont in Marseille. And so when the year after we were winning the league, Dan Carter, Firestarter, was at the club, even though he was injured. And we were definitely going to make the finals. But because it was Lions year, Geach was coaching, and, you know, there was sort of whispers that I might be in with a shout. Geach did ask me if I was picked, would I choose staying to play for the finals or the Lions tour? And I said, well, I would go Lions tour because, you know, that I played rugby till I was 68 years old, and I was probably 40 then. It was never going to happen again. But, you know, at least I might have another shot within top 14 if Perpignan by chance got to played me in the finals or got to the final or won. So I said, I'll definitely go. And that's something you just don't pass up, you know. So I went on tour. During that time, Brian O'Driscoll said to me, look, Michael Checker has been in touch with me and he wants to know, would you be interested in coming to Leinster? I had 1 year left my contract at Perpignan. I was like, well, when you want to go to Leinster, you know, great team, and but I've got 1 year left. But that year that we were successful in 2009, Chris Custer was coming out of contract. They didn't want to resign. Perpignan didn't want to resign him, and I think he went back to Glasgow, didn't he? Beats, I think. Yeah. So because he was leaving, they didn't play him, and that was rubbish for him. He was trying to get back in the Scotland team, and I was like, oh shit, I don't want to spend a year on the bench because they're. Jacques is annoyed that I didn't go to play for the finals. And I said, look, mate, if Perpignan are happy to let me go, I would gladly go to Leinster. So I left Perpignan as a Perpignan player and then went back to Perpignan, packed up my stuff and went to Dublin.
And so when you'd agreed verbally to go on the Lions tour, you obviously then have to have the conversations with Jacques Brunel, with the president of Perpignan, and say you're not available for the phase finale. How did that conversation go down? Like, they must have been pretty unhappy.
Yeah, but they understood that I wanted to do it. I mean, Bernard Guter was the coach, Ford's coach at the time. He was a good friend. And like he was disappointed, but he could see from my side that it was something that couldn't turn down, you know. I mean, I was disappointed. In an ideal world, it would have been amazing if the top 14 season finished and then you could go on a Lions tour. But it wasn't the case. So I sort of had to pick. I didn't know that Perpignan would make the final and go on to win it. Not that it made any difference on my decision, but I was in the hotel room with Stephen Jones in Durban watching the final, and it was awesome to see. The only thing is I didn't get to play another final. Well, I didn't get to play in a final.
You got a few others though.
And that's the thing. I don't regret that decision at all. And that comes down to what I was saying before. As long as you can, you know, at the end of the day, you can be happy with the choices you made and who you are, then you're all good.
And then after a couple of years at Leinster, you move back to France with Clermont. I think you arrived at the same time as Benji, didn't you? What were your first impressions of Benji when you both rocked up at Clermont?
Were you at the same time?
Yeah, 2011.
Really? I thought you were there for me.
I was already a legend there, you know, but you were... No. What happens is that I think... No, you didn't play the World Cup.
No, I did.
Yes, that's why. So you arrived a couple of months after because I didn't play the World Cup. So you were away for that time.
But yeah, it was good. I had French when I was at Perpignan, and then because I've been away, I'd sort of forgotten it. So it was good to have Benji there to speak for me, really, because, you know, Benji likes speaking. We all like that. And no, but it was good to have Benji there because he had... we were quite good that way anyway. We had a lot of people that shared a lot of different backgrounds and different ideas and history. So that was a good thing. I think we came together quite well. But yeah, we had a good time, Benjo.
To be fair, I think Vern, we could speak about him for a long, long time. And he was really instrumental in me going to Clermont. But then he's basically going to get that European experience because Clermont were desperate to get there. And to be honest, I mean, I played with Heinze in one of my biggest disappointments of my whole career, the 2013 Champions Cup final against Toulon.
Stop it.
We had an incredible season and we lose by 1 point, you know, that Dylan Hermitage waving at Brock James. We were the better team that day. It just so happens because we did underperform because one decision of a ref, you know, rugby's like this. And we never really recovered from that. But that was one of the biggest disappointments. Like you said, things really clicked. We had some incredible wins. I mean, we beat Leinster in Leinster. And I remember that was a big game for you.
Smashed them, yeah.
And we absolutely smoked them. And we were really, you know, putting some big, big, big moments. I mean, it was a really incredibly enjoyable time at Clermont. When you know that you want to compete for every game and you know they're going to pick some guys from everywhere in the world to actually do better and better. And we just didn't deliver completely to win in the title together, but it was still extremely enjoyable, like you said.
Yeah, it was. And that final two was pretty poor and that sort of knocked on into the next week, didn't it, against Cast. And that, I remember that training week was probably the weirdest training week I've ever had. It just was so flat and I didn't really have much confidence going in that game. But yeah, that was a real sore point, that final, to be fair, BG. Thanks for making me depressed.
That was one of the lowlights. So give us, on the flip side, give us the highlights of your time in France.
In France?
Asshole!
Yeah, well, that was ridiculous. That was another lowlight. So that was after the quarterfinal against Leinster, we got beat in Bordeaux. I was having a fantastic game. Anyway, Vern takes me off, but I got smashed off a kickoff and my rib was a bit funny. And I thought, well, my rib is a little bit sore. Vern's getting old. Maybe he's just gone a bit demented and he forgot he's taking me off, put Juppé on, I think Julien Pierre on. But I tore the rib cartilage and I didn't really know. And at training the next week, Lionel Four landed on me and like my rib cartilage is separated from my rib, just going clunk, clunk, like that, and it was sticking. It was like stuck, and I just lying there. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything. And I just went, asshole. That's all I could say. And I couldn't even get up. Couldn't walk. And then obviously Benji's there pissing himself. T. Paolo is just pissing himself as well. And I'm like,
Then T. Paolo turns around and looks at the physio. I think there's something wrong with his asshole. And so basically everybody called him asshole until the end of the season. But he's just there complaining about his rib cartilage. And T. Paolo, who was, you know, the former hooker from Crusaders, really lovely bloke, really great in the changing room. He just turned around, physio. I think there's something wrong with his asshole.
Yeah. I heard that. I'm trying not to laugh. I can hardly breathe, and I'm like, but honestly, one of the most painful things in my life. And then the thing, the clinic's only 100, 200 meters up the road, from their training field. So I managed to get up and shuffle my way into the clinic. By that time, I'm white as a sheet and wanted to throw up. Oh, mate, it was painful. That was really painful.
Sounds like a real highlight.
Well, Benji, apparently, so you've asked what my highlight was. Apparently, that's a highlight of Benji.
Yeah.
See me in intense pain. I think Beats can attest to this. It's just a big highlight, I think, is just living and learning about another culture, living in France, learning about another culture, meeting new people. I mean, this is outsiders, holistically speaking, and not talking about rugby, but just being able to experience new stuff and you give your family a different experience. Yeah, I think that's a highlight of living in France. Made some really good friends. Most of my memories are outside of rugby, which is, I don't know, weird.
Normal, mate.
Yeah.
That leads on to this question, and it's an opportunity to give it back to Benji a little bit. You're the perfect person to ask this question to. You've played with Johnny and with Benji. Did you room with either of them? Who was the better teammate? And give it back to them.
Oh, shit. The good thing about, I'm going to do this politically, right? I can't remember. We've roomed together, eh, Bench and Beats.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's memorable because I don't remember doing it, but which is a good thing, right? Because if I did remember, that means you're doing something wrong. Exactly. Because you don't remember the good roomies. You remember the bad ones. But I think, you know, these two clowns, they're good in a team environment. They're good people. And I think you need good people in your team and in your rugby team. And, you know, I enjoyed, I'm not going to say who was better, who was not, because they're both good dudes, right? And that's all you want. You would just want to work with good people. Benji probably blamed me a couple of times for some shit line out calls, which is okay.
Never my fault. Always yours.
Obviously. Benji hates throwing a short lobby throw, because he always got into me about that, which is okay. We just never called that. And then if we did and it was shit, it was his fault. But yeah, that's the good thing about these two guys, is that they're good team blokes and they do anything for the team, and that's what, you know, what you want.
Absolutely. Very disappointing though that you didn't lay into them, but hey.
I thought we'd gone off very lightly there and nothing came out. Well done, Wagga.
That's how I roll, boys. That's how I roll.
So just tell us now, are you itching to get back into coaching? What's next for you?
So I have taken a role with Gallagher Insurance. I am development director and I look after the relationships between PRL, the clubs, and Gallagher, obviously with Gallagher being the title sponsorship of the premiership. The title sponsor of the premiership. So I look after all those relationships, make sure that everyone gets what they need in regards to players and access and all that kind of stuff. And that to help Gallagher introduce rugby to their clients and their future clients, and make sure that we can use rugby as a vehicle to win new business. So that started, obviously it started, I'm in lockdown. So it's been a little bit different. I'm not saying, you know, not exactly difficult, but it's just a bit more of a challenge to meet people over Zoom and get time in the diary to speak to people. But it's much more enjoyable to get to rugby ground and pretend that I'm actually doing something, but I'm not coaching or playing.
So you're not desperate to get back on the coaching field then. And you mentioned as well, you're in Cheshire. So if Alex Sanderson gives you a call and says, hey, fancy sale.
Ooh.
Nah, basically, mate, that's not the case at all. But I spoke to Alex when I was down at Surrey's, because we had a sponsors day down there when we were allowed, and I mentioned it to him. It was just after Steve Diamond stepped aside. But no, at the moment, I'm pretty happy working at Gallagher. It's a good opportunity to do something different. Coaching at the moment, the coaching landscape, like you're saying, Johnny, you have to move around all the time, and with COVID and all, everything's going on, I'm just quite happy to learn something new. I'm still involved in rugby in a capacity. And if the situation changes, I don't get to a rugby game, I'll be really, really happy about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. When we all, well, thanks so much for coming on the show today and sharing all your experiences in France with us, and big good luck for the new role with Gallagher.
Yeah. Thanks very much. Hopefully I will see you guys soon.
Cheers, Wags.
Cheers, Wagga.
Cheers, gents. Been a pleasure.
Great to have Nathan on, eh?
Yeah, he's a legend. One of the best. Like, I still remember my first Scotland tour. I think I actually roomed with Nathan, and it was in Durban in 2007, like ages ago. And just awesome then. Completely looked after me. Lovely bloke. Missus and family are awesome as well.
He's had some career, that's for sure. When you look, I mean, he's got so many. How many caps has he got for Scotland? Like 70 or maybe almost 80?
He retired early as well. So he finished up at a World Cup. I think it was in New Zealand. I think he finished at the World Cup in 2011. Yeah. And he played on for years after that. And I think he got 70, 80 caps. So he's one of the highest.
The British and Irish Lions. I mean, he technically sort of won the top 14 with Perpignan. He definitely won one Champions Cup with Leinster. Yeah. Then he came back to us and he was 35. And the boys like, what are you doing to re-sign a guy like him? And he just kept on going and going. And he was really good, very instrumental. And you could tell he was going. He wanted to be a coach, especially line-outs and forwards coach. He really had a lot of appetite and curiosity towards it. He was always been a serious bloke, good at organizing things and being thorough about what he does. And I was joking around about him and Jamie Cudmore not coming back until a Thursday. Bloody hell, they had some good games, the two of them. They were just incredible. They were about 150 years old combined, but
the two dinosaurs.
They were good. They were good together. And they really, really, the both of them, Jamie, maybe not as much as Wagga, but they really stepped up in the big occasions. Jamie was always good. He was always ruthless, always a monster. But really, he like I mentioned when we had him, that memory, that monster game that he really lined up, Paulo Connell. Heinze was the same. Heinze loves Heineken Cup and Champions Cup. In every big occasion, we played Toulon. He wasn't the same player. We played Champions Cup. He wasn't the same player. And that's when I really recognized greatness, is that whenever you think the guy is limping from Monday to Thursday and you're thinking, well, he's too old for this. But whenever the big occasion was there, he always stepped up and was there and ready to deliver big, big performances. A huge fella who could cover a lot of ground.
I don't think people realize how big he, like you say, Jamie Cudmore and Wagga, but like it's the bulk that they had in terms of muscle bulk and the athleticism. They were unbelievable, the pair of them. And like you said, like the platform, I think of Wagga and I always think back to like big stages, Clermont, Stade Marcel Michelin, and the things that he was doing. Like the images, remember, of him like holding down three Ulster players, being an absolute pest, a complete mutant, but just beasting people, and he did it consistently. He was a machine.
When you almost influence the refs to change a rule, that means that you're doing something right on the pitch, right? Yeah. He was doing like, so he, what is he, 6 foot six? Six? Yep. I don't even know, like something like that. But he would just, around the rucks, grab as many guys, because technically you could. If somebody was grabbed by somebody in the ruck, he was part of the ruck also. But at some point, he was obviously taking it a little bit far. That he was holding two guys with one hand, one with the other, and falling over. He was with his 2 feet holding a fourth guy. And to the point where we had to have a meeting with the refs in Europe saying, listen, none of that, because Nathan Hines, where is he? Yeah, come over here. Right. What you're doing, that's it. Because everybody's copying you and it's becoming a street fight. So let's cut that. So that's a big, big testament to how influential he was.
Well, we mentioned it earlier on, European rugby not happening for the next couple of weekends, but the top 14 is back and some pretty tasty looking games, eh?
Yeah, they had to adapt really quick and get those games going. I focus a lot on Clermont, but I'm quite excited. I think Clermont going to Bordeaux this weekend, that's going to be a big one. Bordeaux are definitely back, putting some big performances, really stepping up from almost to their old self, what they were last year without Semir Adradra, putting big performance after big performance. Really excited about that. Excited to see that last week, Toulouse, Stade Français, the little superstars of French rugby are still there. I mean, every time Antoine Dupont touches the ball, something happens.
He's electric, man.
I don't even want to speak to him about him anymore. I mean, that's it. We've done it enough. On and on again. He's probably going to kill it. So now all I expect from him is to win the World Cup. Otherwise, I'll be disappointed, basically. That's how good he can be, I think.
Yeah, the other one's Simon Pelle cast. Again, Philippe Saint-André, the effect he's had on the team, obviously improved performances, but they still lost their past two games since he's taken charge. And actually, they find themselves under a bit of pressure at home to cast, who have won the last two games after two red cards. They've gone down to 14 men for pretty much the duration of the game, but they've won their games. So it doesn't get easier for Montpellier. The other one, I'm going up to Paris. I'm doing Racing Toulon for Canal Plus. That should be an absolute, that should be a biggie as well. Lots of talent on show, but just good to have it back. Like compare it to the Prem, like we're just lucky to have rugby to watch. And it means that hopefully we're not going to have this fixture pile up and the scheduling being an absolute mess at the end of the year.
And then we need to talk about, are you allowed to, you know, we talked about being a forwards coach and talk about lineouts and stuff, but are you allowed to lift the ref up in the air to celebrate a win? So
I'll give you my feeling of it. So Nevers was so chuffed to win in Béziers because obviously it's a tough, big old win. And the last decision of the ref was going to be the decision maker to allow the try or not from Béziers, whether they won or not. So he's already dancing around the ref, waiting for that.
He saw his face.
And then it's just a genuine, childish, stupid reaction. Okay, but it's genuine and kind and funny and passionate, right? It comes from the heart. It's not, he doesn't want to hurt him. He doesn't want to be angry. It doesn't come from any bad side of his heart. So I would forgive anything. I was more pissed off about the reaction of the Béziers players.
Yeah, look 100%.
At them all the way around. They're all going up to the ref like I've never seen it. Like what I hate about football. When exactly. I see those guys sprinting and coming to the face of the ref, I started screaming and stuff. And the ref is there, poor thing. I mean, I would distribute some red cards if I was a football ref. Like, don't even get close to my face. You're gone. And all those Béziers guys are, are we allowed to do this? Are we allowed to do that? And even though it doesn't change the faith of the game, because the score was, the try was not meant to be allowed, they're still there to complain. So I'm like, listen, this is not rugby. If we start to have problem in the stands, if we start to have disrespectful players to the refs, and if we start to have players who, after a big scruffle, after a big game, don't shake hands and do this thing of, you know, you smash the shit out of each other on the field and then you respect each other off it. If we lose that, we lose everything we've got. And we lose our difference with any other sport. So I think it's a matter of, obviously, the Fijian player was there, Haizuke.
Yeah.
Cannot touch the ref, okay? Do not touch the ref. You cannot do that.
Yeah.
But it's just a mistake, okay? So let's not make it bigger than it is, especially at the moment. We're so chuffed to see some rugby. So I hope he gets a week ban like it should
100%.
Be.
100%. Max, I hope that's the kicker for me, is I hope that you obviously can't touch a ref. The ref's clearly embarrassed. You have to be embarrassed in that situation, but he's got no choice but to send them off. That's the sad thing. It's come out of joy. It's the right decision. But I just hope that they look at circumstance, look at what's going on in the world, and like a week max ban. Just, you know, give him a slap on the wrist, but let's get him back. He knows not to do it again. Because if the ref doesn't do anything, what's next? Is somebody going to grab and like give somebody a nuke? Like, you can't be touching a ref. So 100% the right decision, but just, you know, a week ban and get him back in. He's learned his lesson. It won't happen again.
I know for a fact that the ref went into the Nevers change room after. It's funny. The ref went into the change room almost to address it. And he looked at the guys like, come on, what have you done? But almost wanted to apologize for giving him a red card. And before he said anything, the Fijian player came over and apologized. He said, I'm truly sorry. it was a mistake. I didn't mean any disrespect. It's just that it was a stupid reaction. What do you mean to say? My heart is too big. And yes. I didn't think enough. And actually they shook hands and, you know, and went from there. There was no disrespect wanted, and I think move on.
Absolutely. And should we quickly talk about some of the rumors, transfer rumors? You love a transfer rumor, don't you, Benji? Contract agent time.
Yeah, well, listen, if I heard that, what is it, the back row of Bath, Zach Mercer, that's what Zach you just Mercer. Told me. Is linked who I think to be fair, I think is a very good player. I really do rate him. I think he's maybe not a number eight, but he's not the biggest dude. But wow, he's got some
he's
wheels.
Athletic,
he's got
man.
Some really, yeah, he's got some real ability. I really enjoy playing, seeing him play. It more disappoints me to think what the hell is wrong with Bath. They've got fantastic Whoa. Players all around. They could have Underhill, Mercer, and what is and Faletau. And they're just constantly in the middle of not really performing and being good. And especially players don't want to stay. So I think, is he from there originally?
He's a bit from everywhere. So his dad okay. was my Scotland, he was my really? Defense coach. His dad was my defense coach up in Glasgow. And so Gary's the dad, Zach's the boy. So Zach, they were obviously, Gary was a leaguey and he played down south in England. So Zach was born down south, but then finished his schooling up in Scotland.
Okay.
And like you said, really talented player. I think he played maybe Scotland under 18s and then went to England under 20s. But you say, like, how are Bath not retaining the talent? So Zach's obviously one of those kids that isn't going to play ahead of Billy Vunipola, isn't going to play ahead of Curry, isn't going to start in an England jersey. And I don't think, like, Bath obviously want to keep him. He's English qualified. He would be easy QP, obviously. He's important to them. But Montpellier have obviously just opened the checkbook and been like, boom, here you come, and they can't compete. That's the only reason he would go to Montpellier.
Yeah, but you always have to counterbalance the money with the risk that he's taken for his career. That, like we said with Heinze, we spoke about 2 hours about the lack of stability of this club.
That's it. So he's saying goodbye to his English. Any hope he had or had retained of playing for England is gone. You then go to Montpellier. Yes, you take a nice paycheck. You live in the sunshine, but you temper that with you're under Philippe Saint-André. They're in dire straits. They're second bottom of the top 14. it doesn't look like the quality of the rugby is going to improve anytime soon.
Philippe Santelier admitted that he's only coach until June. So the guy is signing with a coach that doesn't even need, well, obviously any coach would like Zach Mercer, okay, but maybe a coach would want to come with his own number 8 or number 6. You know, you just don't know. The
uncertainty is a huge risk. Although maybe behind the scenes, they've already got a coach in place who said, I want to bring this guy and as part of the project. We don't know that. But if you're Zach Mercer, you're signing in blind faith purely for a big paycheck. In my opinion, it's a bad move.
And what about the slightly off the wall one? Israel Folau to Toulon. Any truth in that whatsoever with all his baggage?
I don't know, mate, but I want to see him back in Union. Like, in spite of the scandal and what's gone on and points of views and religious, won't get into it, but mate, he's one of the best 15s in the world. And I think there's one place that you can go and be forgiven or people are less politically correct, Benji, I could say. Like France in the top 14 would suit him down to the ground. He'd be exceptional in France. He's obviously at the Catalan Dragons and doing really well in league, but it'd be great to have him back, and Toulon would be a great fit, 100%.
Yeah, it's one of them. I think he can believe whatever he wants, as long as he doesn't offend others by expressing it. Actually, I really don't care. I think we're all completely different. We all have the right to believe in whatever we want. It's just the offense given by expressing it in such a harsh way, even though you have to understand if that's his belief, that's his belief, you know, no problem. He's obviously, like Johnny said, one of the best, one of the most incredible, talented fullbacks or just backs, attacking style rugby in the world. So you want to see him on the field, right? My only issue is that the club that's going to take him is going to have to open the checkbook, because he's going to have a lot of offers from a bit of everywhere in the world. And I just hope that he picks a place where it's not only going to be about the checkbook, but he's actually going to be able to enjoy his rugby, enjoy his time. If he's lived in Perpignan, he's starting to love a little bit the French sunshine, then going to Toulon will be extraordinary, and they will allow him to be, like you said, to be a bit loud and a bit crazy. But for Toulon to do that, it's going to be a matter of salary cap that then we're going to have to address. So I'm excited to see him play in top 14. If he decides to get in, not put a leash, you know, but understand that what he says can hurt and can be sore for others, and actually take a decision that will be beneficiary for his well-being, his career, and just to see his God-given talent, because he can be extraordinary.
And just finally, what's going on with Gabriele Bitoy? Because Agen don't seem happy with him. Is he going to Montpellier? What's happening with him?
Well, he was phenomenal at the start of the year, but the rest of the team at Agen wasn't. And he signed, obviously, came over to France with a pro de deux clause. So if they get relegated, he has a clause that he can get out and sign for another team. So I don't know. It's a weird one for Agen to hit back at him. When actually on the field, he produced the goods and he was one of the few shining lights of that Agen side. I don't know. It's just bad for him to play out in the press and then to be slacking him off for looking at other teams. That's clearly the realistic situation that they all find themselves in. The club isn't in a situation where they can retain him for next year. He's played well. He's going to attract offers from other places. I don't know what you think, Benji, but
for one, the whole Agen season, unfortunately, is a shambles. They haven't won a game. It's very, very complicated. They got in a fight coming back from a European game that they didn't, because guys were pissed on the plane in front of some young fans. So the season is not going well. The coach got sacked. Then another coach comes in, and then the president is disappointed with it and states the names of guys he thinks are not performing well and not giving everything for a jersey and pulled them out of the squad. That's the general atmosphere, unfortunately, at Agen, which is not going well. They're going to get relegated and things are not going their way. And on top of that, this summer, remember when he signed, we said it's a funny signing for him to take a big risk to go to Agen. Very good. So like Johnny said, he's going to attract some interest. I think maybe he lost interest in the Agen season. This season also, because he was expecting a lot more. Maybe he got some poor advice from his agents or from his decision makers. So I don't think it's very extraordinary to see him being linked to other clubs. I think Bayonne came to the charge to try to get him during the season, and then
Montpellier as well.
Have done it. So I think he's going to leave, and basically the club's decision is, because we're going to get relegated, if you're going to leave, you might as well leave now, save ourselves a little bit of cash and sort out the solution now.
Excellent. Thanks, Benji. Thanks, Johnny. Good to be back, guys.
I missed you both. It's good to be back.
Good to be back. Have a good day, guys. Enjoy. Looking forward to next week.
Absolutely. A big thanks to Nathan Hines as well, and for all of you for listening. Make sure you hit subscribe, leave us a nice review, and we'll be back with another episode next week. Cheers, guys.
Cheers, fellas.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.